Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And I don't know if you can hear the difference in the sound quality in the past couple of episodes, but that is because we are building a room for all of this to be recorded in, so that hopefully the sound quality will be a lot better. At some point. But that said, it is freezing cold in this garage as the insulation's not up yet completely. And that leads me to the conversation that we have today with today's guest, Rachel Caudill. And you can hear us kind of shivering a little bit, but it's not all shivering. Unfortunately, as I mentioned in the notes for the show, if you are a person who is triggered by sexual assault and suicidal ideation or suicidal behavior, this one's going to be hard for you. I'm not going to lie. I've actually been sitting on this interview, for a little while now. And the reason for that is because I discuss my sexual assault. And we were comfortable, we were having a conversation, and that's where it went. And, you know, I've always considered myself to be a pretty open book. I've never really thought of myself as a person who was afraid to share, certainly not with you people. And here we are. I discuss one of the times I was sexually assaulted, and I guess by saying it that way, I acknowledge that it's happened more than once. And maybe at some point we'll get into that. I don't know. This is all kind of difficult for me. But that said, we have a really great conversation about a lot of things. And after talking to her about it, and her being brave enough to share her story with me, I actually felt a lot better. So as nervous as I was to put this out in the world, after listening back to it, I actually feel pretty good about it. And it's terrifying when someone takes away that part of yourself. It's absolutely terrifying. But, you know, I'm a grown man now, and I've had to own the ways in which it shaped me, the ways in which I was wrong about certain things, and the way that it made me treat other people. And, I mean, honestly, all you can do is try to be better, right? And I was constantly afraid and dismissive and judging other people's motives for things, and always assuming that that kind of violence and that kind of behavior was in every other human being I met all the time. I just assumed, men, women, I just assumed that everyone had that kind of darkness in them. And if I'm being honest with you, I still have trouble with that. I think it still colors the perception of my relationships with people, just as a knee-jerk reaction. And because I know that about myself, I have to own it, and I have to make an effort to change. Because it's one thing to say, you know, I have this issue because, and just leave it at that. But that's not the end. There isn't an end. There's only ever better. Try to be better today than you were yesterday. And that's really all I know how to do anymore, is just try to be better and try to really think about other people before I think about myself. And try to come to terms with the fact that the things that happened to me may have led me to be really terrible to other people. Just treating them like they were the problem. When really it was just me. Afraid to get close, afraid to trust. And afraid to be good to people for fear that it would get me hurt. So, this conversation was really healing for me. And I hope that you get something out of it too, regardless of whether or not anything like this has ever happened to you. And I hope that it hasn't. So without further ado, I give you this great conversation with Rachel Caudill. So hi, first of all, how are you?
I'm all right. I've been busy, which is always nice.
Busy in the workshop making the art.
Busy fixing up a gallery.
Yeah.
So it's welcoming. I work out of a gallery that used to be a pawn shop. So
nice.
It still looks like a pawn shop.
That's kind of awesome, though.
It's really an amazing space. There's so much space of it there. First of all.
Yeah.
But it does. It still feels like a pawn shop. So we're fixing the floors and painting murals on the outside of the building and painting the walls, getting more art in there every day.
Well, that's all the stuff that needs to get done.
Yeah, mostly.
Yeah. So when did you first figure out that that was going to be your jam?
I don't know if I've figured it out yet, to be quite honest. I had a bit of a mental health crisis continuing through most of 2017 and quit my job.
Uh-huh.
So I'm functionally unemployed, which gives me the opportunity to be like, okay, what do I want to do?
Yeah.
And it's not go to an office. My prior career was HR, and I don't ever want to do that again.
Yeah, I would imagine that that had something to do with leading to the mental health crisis.
Yeah. Part of it, it's like you combine depression and a genetic predisposition towards suicidal ideation and add in some trauma. And eventually you're just going to end up with not being able to take care of yourself and hating everything about your life.
Yeah. But I think that that's pretty common for the people that I know that work in offices.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wonder if the two just feed each other, if it's one of those things where it's not necessarily that the office itself is bad, but that people who have damage are drawn to it somehow. I don't know. That's a tough call.
Yeah. There's something about going to the same place every day on a schedule that's set by somebody else.
Yeah.
Entirely. From when you get there, to when you can eat, to when you leave, to what you're doing with your day.
Yeah. 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 I have that same, I mean, that's absolutely what I'm doing for a living. Mm-hmm. You know, I go into a place and every single time I look at it and I go, well, the terms are acceptable.
Yes.
You know, that's the only thing I can think to myself. But as I do this more and more, and as I get older, I've really started to care a lot less and think, You know, I mean, you can fire me.
Yes.
And, you know, no hard feelings if you do, because I get it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've worked in an industry where I fire people.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So you must have met people like you.
Yes, yes. I've also only ever quit one job.
Yeah.
So, like, I am that person.
Well, where are you from? Are you from Colorado originally?
I am, yeah.
Whereabouts?
I was born and grew up in Brighton.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you had some of that kind of instilled in you, probably, from a younger age. Like, did your parents give you any of that? Like, that whole, like, you get a job, you keep it kind of thing?
Kind of. My dad did for a long time in his life. He was a plumber, and it was a family business, so he was up at the crack of dawn every day off to work. He got cancer when I was 17, and he died when I was 18.
Oh,
so
man.
That year in between, he kind of let go of a lot of that and was really focused on just saying, do what you want. Do what makes you happy.
Yeah.
I still ended up finishing college and getting a degree I'm never going to use.
What's your degree in?
I got a degree in education.
Oh, man. I don't know. I would argue that there's, well, I mean, mostly just because the sake of devil's advocate on this, but I would argue that education has its own value. I mean, you do learn a handful of things. Mostly you end up with a shitload of debt, but you do learn some things, and you learn a lot of things about yourself and how you process information. And if you can take that experience and make it malleable to what you want to get out of it, it can be rewarding in its own sake. Like I decided I was going to go to college 2 years ago for the first time in my life. And so I started, and I am very slowly working my way through a 5-year associate's degree.
What are you going for?
Film.
Film.
Which is useless. I don't need it. You know what I mean? Like, I could learn everything I need to know about film from YouTube or the internet on my own, because I am voraciously excited about it. But I kind of figured I've never gone to college, and there's a bunch of stuff it's going to make me do before I get to the stuff I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see if I'm capable of doing the things it wants to make me do. And I want the information. And so I took a bunch of, you know, philosophy classes and art history classes and things like that that I didn't necessarily have any interest in. I wasn't against it. Like, what am I going to use art history for? It was more like, yeah, I don't know how to apply this and make it something that I'll be good at.
Hmm.
And it turned out that I did like it. And I did enjoy the stuff that I got out of it. But I also do know a lot of people that went to school for a purpose. And they're like, yeah, that was a big waste of time.
One thing I remember about school is it was nice to have something that I had to go do every day.
Yeah.
And it's something I've noticed since I haven't really been working, mm-hmm. that it's hard to make yourself stay motivated if you don't have something to go do every day.
Yeah.
To stay even positive, and it makes it really easy to slip into depression when you don't have something to go do every day.
Yeah.
Which I think also helps a lot with the learning process when you have to do this. You don't have to do anything.
Right.
But, you know, you've created this obligation for yourself.
Yeah.
You're
holding yourself accountable.
Yeah. You're not having any do-nothing days. That's what my therapist calls it.
Yeah.
It's the do-nothing days. You avoid them because you just get sucked into this trap.
Yeah.
So I could see that about going back to school, just like you're forcing yourself to do things in a new way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and some of it was also mania.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like thinking, I could do this. Yeah, I could go to school. I could go to film school. I can make a movie. Like, yeah, I could figure out how to do this. I could meet other like-minded individuals and make this happen and scrape something together and, Yeah, and I started writing scripts, and I had all these ideas. And then, of course, like every other thing that happens out of mania, the crash comes one morning, and you go, what have I done? So let's go backward, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
And just, so when was the first time you met your depression?
Oh. I mean, it feels like something that's always been there.
Yeah.
Like, I can't remember not having depression. And that might be that I don't have a great memory, which is true.
Yeah. Well, memory's tricky anyway.
Yeah. But it's just, it seems like it's something I've always felt and I've always been familiar with, and it's mm-hmm. always been around.
Yeah. So, like, even, like, as a little kid, like, just, I'm different.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Even if it was just being a weird kid, and
yeah,
maybe those things go hand in hand too. Depression and being really weird.
I think the two can definitely exacerbate each other.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think, which one of those caused the first steps of isolation? Because I think, at least for me, in the parts of my life where I really, really feel and remember what my depression felt like.
Mm-hmm.
So much of it was isolation and self-isolating.
Yeah.
And maybe that exacerbated being a weird kid.
Yeah, I was isolationist too. I ended up finding out later that my particular cocktail was bipolar 1. So what was your... Did you ever get an official diagnosis on...
Yeah, it's just depression and generalized anxiety.
I mean, isn't that enough?
Yeah, right. that was previous. Now I have a little bit of PTSD thrown in on top of it, so that makes life more complicated.
PTSD is something that I've just been kind of beginning to understand better over the course of the past few years, mm-hmm. and recognizing that it can come from any number of sources. Like it was one of those things that, you know, like when you're a kid, you're told things like don't swallow gum because you can't digest it.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. PTSD was one of those things where I always just sort of took it for granted that it was, well, this is for like combat veterans and things like that. Regular people don't get that unless they've been through something insane. But the difference is just about every experience a human being has is going to affect them in a way that might not affect other people. And so it doesn't matter what it was. There's not a scale for trauma for human beings other than your trauma. And so PTSD happens to people all the time and goes undiagnosed and everything. And I definitely have it. I certainly started to feel it. I don't ever get political on this thing, but lately it seems like it's happened a couple of times. And I definitely have it, like, after the 2016 election. I have PTSD from that.
Yeah, that the 2016 election pretty much kicked off a full year of trauma for me.
Yeah.
And not connecting it necessarily directly with the election, but it was almost like the universe saying, hey, this is the new reality. Like,
yeah.
Get used to this.
Yes.
Here's some shit that's going to happen to you. Enjoy the trauma.
Yeah. Like, yeah. It was a rough thing for me to see a lot of danger. Because, I've always been, I've always been a little, I guess, outside the realm for the rest of my family, which is why I moved here, like, away. But, to have people getting in conversations with me about, supporting the Klan and Nazis,
oh,
and
God.
It's like, I didn't, this is a thing that we've always kind of not talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're telling me, and now I have to know this instead of guess. And now that I know this, I have a responsibility to not tell you that that's all right.
I'm going to try not to cough into the microphone real quick. Yeah, it's wild how many people are feeling really comfortable in just broadcasting their weird ideas. And
yeah.
To take it out of the realm of politics, it's not just in politics, but
certainly.
It's really apparent in politics. But, you know, we live in this era of social media where everybody's always putting their ideas out.
Yeah.
All of them, like pretty unfiltered.
Yeah. Yeah. I was struck by something today, as a matter of fact, you know, about how the world has changed and in this digital landscape where everything is the way that it is. I was watching reading that Beastie Boys book, their autobiography, and I was reading that and, you know, just kind of them as old men now chronicling with their memory going, oh yeah, I was stupid and this, that, and the other thing, and then we got better, and then we tried to free Tibet, yay, you know. And so you see this journey towards progressive ideas and things, as you would hope human beings do. And all of that's fine. The issue came when I went looking for something, as I was reading the book, and there was a mention of a song or something, and I thought, I'm going to walk around and I'm going to find a video on YouTube. And I did. And it was a video of what I'm almost certain was sexual assault. And I was horrified.
Oh my God.
like I couldn't wrap my head around these two conflicting ideas at the same time. Like, oh, these are people I like. And now I just saw a thing that I can't not see anymore. And now all I can think about is like, this is terrible. did anyone ever like atone for this? Or it was basically just, you know, hanging out backstage after a party and just like gross. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I wasn't watching a snuff film or anything, but it was just gross. It was just icky, like unwanted touching. Don't do that to a person. And man, that's in this day and age, I think most people are, I think, more thoughtful of what it is they're doing, even if they're creeps. So I guess that's a net positive is sort of what I'm getting at.
Like, even the creeps are a little bit more careful.
Like. Yeah. When it comes to actions, but when it comes to their thoughts, man, everybody's got to know everything.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of weird to think about how, you know, media in the internet age has changed in those two like really divergent ways.
Yeah.
You look at movies where, you know, I saw something today that was people just being shocked at how horribly sexist American Pie was.
Yeah.
Like, and it was kind of a beloved movie.
Yeah.
In a way.
Sure.
And now
they made like nine of them.
Yeah. You could never, like, you could put that in a movie, but people would not appreciate it.
Yeah.
You know, the girl getting filmed secretly while taking her clothes off. Like,
yeah.
That's an example that pops out. You couldn't do that now.
Right.
And have it be okay. But then you have people like actively spouting the same kind of thought processes.
Yeah.
And it's acceptable. It's really, it's like a satire film. Like, it's like,
yeah,
a parody movie to think about these two things somehow coexisting.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of that going on. So I would have to imagine that your experience being a woman in America growing up in this day and age, I mean, is it all knuckle keys and mace these days?
Like, I mean, I came to a stranger's home.
Yeah.
And later at night. I mean, it's dark out.
Yeah.
In a neighborhood I'm not familiar with, you know.
Yeah.
So I would say there is some overhyping of the whole mace and the keys and the knuckles.
Sure.
For sure. Cause, and I say this as a sexual assault survivor, mm-hmm, as well. It is dangerous out there for women.
Certainly. And I don't mean to make light of that. Yeah. I think that the thing is probably more or less that it's, you have to figure out where you're going to take your chances, mm-hmm. or else you're just going to be in a box.
Absolutely. I remember the first time after my sexual assault that I felt comfortable leaving the house alone. Mm-hmm. And it was shortly after Anthony Bourdain died. I watched through No Reservations again, and it was like, okay, I should leave the fucking house.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt that way too. So you're just going backwards, and you growing up with depression, and then what did that manifest itself as, like, when you were little?
I don't remember.
Like, no?
I really don't. I remember having, like, emotional breakdowns in my early, like, I guess, tweens.
Yeah.
11, 12. Just horrible meltdowns of crying fits. And that's probably the earliest I can remember, like, having an active reaction.
It's really hard to pinpoint that stuff for a lot of people sometimes, because just general teenagehood and adolescence is hard enough already. So how do you know which thing is bending your reality? but then growing up in Brighton and, you know, doing your thing, kicking around with your family. What was your jam? Like, what was bringing you happiness at that time?
I read a lot of books.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. I read a lot of books and I drew a lot of dumb pictures.
Yeah? Like what? What would you draw?
I actually found a sketchbook of mine from when I was, I don't know, probably 13, 14.
Uh-huh.
I drew a lot of pictures of, like, actual garbage.
Just...
Yeah, crumpled up aluminum cans and pieces of tin foil. Strange little monsters. Just very, a lot of garbage. Like vacuum cleaners. There's like 6 pages of vacuum cleaners.
That's kind of amazing. What do you think you were trying to say with that?
I think I was trying to make mundane objects interesting.
Huh.
And, like, put them into this fantasy realm of the books that I was getting sucked into all the time.
Yeah. I would say that I can still see bits and pieces of that carry over into your work now. When I look at the artistic stuff that you've done now, like the Speak and Spell.
Oh, yeah.
You know, repurposed. There was the flyer. With all of the people's heads.
Oh. cult leader heads.
Yes. So just taking these things, I mean, that's an artistic expressionist kind of thing to do anyway, is to just take bits and pieces from things. Obviously, you're seeing things a little bit different. After a certain point, it's difficult to separate those ideas between, you know, what makes you artistic and, you know, is it your depression driving and making you see things differently? Or are you just an artistic person who happens to be depressed? And we haven't yet figured out how to answer those questions.
Yeah. I mean, for me, most of my art isn't really depressed.
Sure.
And I'm not totally sure how much of that is deliberate on my part. A lot of the time, it absolutely is, because I'm not always comfortable going into my depression feelings and thinking that deeply about it, and in a way where I'm trying to challenge it into some kind of a visual concept that other people might understand. Like,
yeah,
I don't really care if they understand, but it makes it more concrete to think about it that way.
Yeah.
But the rest of the time, I'm, you know, drawing pictures of hot dogs.
But again, that idea of these found objects, you know, like the tin cans and the tin foil, and even vacuum cleaners to a certain degree. That's all, I mean, that is all dealing with refuse. Mm. And I would have to imagine that, I mean, it sounds like, and not to get all analytical on it, but it does definitely seem like you're saying something with that. Even if it's subconsciously, it almost seems obvious, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
But there's something kind of beautiful in that at the same time.
Yeah, for sure.
So were you always making things like that?
Yeah, mostly. I kind of transitioned into different types of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been drawing weird little pictures.
Yeah.
I don't think I really keyed into what to do with those weird little pictures until, I don't know, the last couple years,
mm-hmm.
Which is put it in jewelry.
Yeah. Yeah, where did the idea for the bolo ties come from?
Yeah, my friend Klaus was making bolo ties from brothel coins. So
that's a cool idea.
Yeah, they're really lovely and incredibly inappropriate.
Yeah, yeah.
but we were going to little craft markets and hanging out, and he was selling his bolo ties, and I was selling these concrete egg candle holder things. And I just saw how much people liked them, and I really liked them too. And I've been playing around with jewelry ideas for a while and never really figured out something to put it on that I really, really, really liked.
Yeah.
So I started putting it on bolo ties, and I've been making some bolo tie slides with Klaus too, and it's just something just feels good about it.
Yeah. Well, they're certainly artistically interesting. I mean, you can do a lot with them, and it's one of those neat things when you start combining art with jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of awesome because it's something you can wear.
Absolutely,
you can take it with you. So that's a fascinating prospect, and also with the T-shirts, like.
Yeah.
So you're all about wearable art.
I do really enjoy wearable art. And I'm really aware that part of it is ego on my part, being like, I want to see somebody wearing something that I made and know that they're wearing it all the time.
Yeah.
You know, or frequently. And I totally recognize that's my ego, being like, oh, that's cool. That's mine. I made
sure.
That. I did that. But it's also important for me to be able to embrace, like, pride in what I do.
Certainly.
And what I make. That's been a really big thing for me in getting out of depression and doing something every day.
Yeah, I think that there's a tendency to give ego a bad rap all the time. Because ego can be very helpful, especially in combating depression. The kind of thing that you're talking about, that pride, mm-hmm. at I made a thing, is more or less the idea of taking something that didn't exist in the world, and now you put it there, and now it's like in defiance of eternity, your name is on the wall. You know, you're finger painting on the cave. We've always done it, and I think that there are ways to do that. You know, without engaging in too much braggadocio or anything, but it's not so much that it has to be, you know, you're either screaming at people to look at you, or you're begging people to look at you. You know, sometimes it's just wanting to be seen, and needing to have that connection with humanity to say, I don't necessarily know how I fit into all of this, but this is my contribution. And even if only for this moment, I haven't figured anything else out, but I did figure out this fucking tie.
Yeah. No, there's absolutely a validation aspect to it, which
yeah.
is like, I can feel so strongly about something that I make, but somebody else is also saying, oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's pretty awesome. You know, I spent a good number of years as a musician just because I needed somewhere to put things. Like, I needed some level of validation or else I wasn't going to leave the house. Because I didn't have it in me to interact with other human beings. I mean, even now, interacting with you, we are across from a table. I have a microphone in front of me. I have headphones on. There are so many barriers. And yet, at the same time, I'm willing to use all of these things as, you know, my safety against, you know, telling you about, you know, my sexual assault or my depression or, you know, the things that have happened to me, and feel completely vulnerable and comfortable while being completely safe. Because there's safety in, you know, accoutrement.
Yes.
This stuff is in front of it. And so now you're getting this piece. It's an interesting thing that I haven't quite figured out how to nail down yet.
Mm-hmm.
But here we are.
Yeah, I haven't quite figured out how to nail it down either. I've been trying to figure out ways to express more of my negative feelings through art.
Yeah.
And it's really hard.
Yeah.
It's painful and it's unpleasant. But I put through an application to Meowwolf, and that was trying to channel so much of that into just, and it was the first time I'd ever really made myself think about it.
Yeah.
In that way, which goes back to, you know, it helps to have a goal, to have something you have to do.
Right.
I have to turn in this application because I want to. I'm making myself do it. So I'm making myself try to think of ways to visualize all of these negative feelings.
Yeah, there's a tendency for people to believe that all art comes through suffering, but that's not always the case. A lot of times, even, you know, negative seeming art came from when you were in a better place. It can be really hard to make things when you're not in a good place.
Absolutely. Well, also being in a better place gives you the distance to think about it.
Yeah.
The distance to think about it without going through all those same exact feelings again. I think there's, you don't want to re-traumatize yourself, I guess.
Yeah.
So having that space from it where you've already processed it on the emotional level and on this kind of rational level where you've gone through that process, then you can think about it again without re-triggering all of those feelings, all of that pain.
Yeah.
So it was actually really, really helpful for me to go through that, writing it down and trying to put it into a package for somebody else to see and understand. Drawing out sketches of these concepts that are weird. Like, gigantic fuzzy teddy bears with knives and hammers, you know? That's like the briefest image sketch
It.
But, and trying to describe that in, you know, like 150 words.
Yeah.
It was really helpful for me to think about all this pain and just distill it down for me, not just in presenting it to someone else, but for me to have this like synopsis, this like little synopsis. Here's all my feelings. Here's it put into a way that I connect with. A package that I feel really strongly about, and it's understandable for me. That was really powerful, and just like coming to a better place, being able to think about it, putting that together. I'm still just like shocked at how good it felt to do that.
Yeah, have you always been kind of the mindset that you needed to be aware of how your emotions were going to help dictate your behavior?
Oh, yeah. One of the things that my mom said to me at a really early age was like, you can't control other people, but you can control how you respond. And I've carried that with me through my whole life. And in order to control how I respond, I need to know what's going on inside my head, and just think about it. it has had me, I've had a tendency to overthink things sometimes. So now I'm working on the opposite side of that. Feel it, know what you're feeling, but you don't have to overthink it. You don't have to think about it constantly. You don't have to overanalyze every aspect of what your feelings are doing in your life. You can act with instinct sometimes, and it's totally okay.
Yeah. You mentioned, excuse me, now I'm doing stuff. It's the sawdust in here, I think, maybe. You mentioned earlier the suicidal ideation, and I think that it might be easy to make some assumptions about that, but I guess what interests me about that when I talk to other people who experience that, because I definitely have that, is, and this is going to come out sounding strange, so I'm just going to say it. Do you like yourself?
I do now.
Yeah.
That's not always been the case.
Right.
And I still have days where I'm like, I hate myself.
Yeah.
I don't want to be even in the same room with myself. I don't want to take care of myself. Why would I bother?
Yeah.
But for the most part, I do. I like myself.
Yeah.
I enjoy my own company. Again, I went through a long period of time where I just did not enjoy my own company. And I mean, I do now. I spend a lot of time by myself, and I really, really value that time.
But how did you pull yourself out of that? Like to the point where, again, you can't control the fact that these thoughts and feelings are going to come at you. But after a certain point, you do have to start owning them.
Mm-hmm.
So was it therapy, or was it something else that started to bring you out of that?
It was therapy, for sure. I can't downplay the benefit of therapy at all.
Yeah.
But when my suicidal ideation was really, really strong, it was about a year ago, and I went and I researched the most painless ways to kill yourself, and I ordered the supplies, and they're still in a box in my closet, in the back of my closet. I hadn't even opened up the shipping container.
Yeah.
And I think knowing that I have that option made me think of the other option. And I could focus on something else, because I knew that was there. Like, if that's really something that I want to do, mm-hmm. I can. I just can. And it's my choice.
Yeah.
Since it's my choice, I can make the other one too.
Right.
It actually made the feeling less, like, intense. It didn't feel so oppressive. Just to know that there was choice there.
Was it the act of starting to make plans that made you think, maybe I should get a second opinion other than mine?
I mean, I was in therapy before that, for a couple of months. It's just wasn't really doing me much good. I wasn't taking it seriously. I was kind of just paying it lip service and just saying what I knew my therapist wanted to hear. And she knew it.
Yeah.
But what can you do in that situation as a therapist?
Yeah.
You
can either wait and see if the person opens up, or, you know.
Yeah.
I guess you can try pounding on somebody until they crack open, but, you know, what are the odds that's going to work?
Right. So she just, you know, kept talking to me, like, in a way where I knew that she knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
Like, I knew I was going to get called out. If I'd continue to go at this and continue in that therapeutic relationship without making without taking any action.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just about making decisions or having thoughts and thinking about it or writing out notes or having a plan. It's about actually doing it.
Yeah.
Which I think also helped with having my suicide plan. It's like, okay, I actually have to do it then.
Yeah. I had my first experience with a therapist. I definitely did that because I was a people pleaser. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted my therapist to like me. And so I wanted them to think they were doing a good job. And he was terrible. It wasn't until I saw somebody else later that I realized, oh, they're different. And, okay, this is fine. Like, this, I can work with this person because she's, like, much different than this other guy. And so I saw someone for quite a long time. But then even the trouble with that is that I kind of got everything I was going to get from that person. And I started talking her off the ledge. And I was paying, you know, $80 to do it.
Oh, man.
You know, just like, okay, well, I hope you're all right and you can call me.
Whew, yikes. Okay.
Yeah, so that was fantastic. And that was when that was pretty much when I knew for sure, like, okay. So we've, sometimes a therapy relationship can run its course.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, who knows? I mean, that's a thing to think of too, is that a therapy relationship with somebody can run its course, and then maybe it's time to just check in with somebody else or check out for a while. You never really know, but I mean, you kind of know yourself. That's not nothing.
Yeah, you know your own coping the best.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the best they can do in any given circumstance is lay out a number of tools and have four or five that are going to work for you in your own way. But they're not going to fix anything. You're going to fix things. All they can do is show you the menu.
Yeah. A lot of the time for me, therapy has also been a place to vent, mm-hmm. Without fearing any repercussions, especially social repercussions. Like, I can go talk to any of my friends and complain about my day and what other people were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But if they know some of the people I'm talking about, and I'm not saying great things, it's not something I want to do. I don't want to cause trauma or drama or tension or any of that with any of my friends. So it's like, okay, then who do I just like blab to? And that, a lot of, on my good weeks, that's my therapist. On my bad weeks, we talk a lot more about managing trauma response, recognizing triggers before they happen. I'm glad I found my therapist because she can do both of those things easily and really seamlessly. So if I tend to get rambly a lot of the time. So I'll go from complaining about my day to talking about trauma responses.
No, but it's good to be able to switch gears like mm-hmm. that. Honestly, there's not really a right way to do it. More or less, the only right way to do it is honestly. And if that happens to take you in five or six different directions, so be it. So it sounds like you've got a lot of stuff in place to really lock it all down.
I mean, it's all there.
Yeah.
But then the rest of it is, like, it's on me. I have to follow through.
Yeah.
And that's the if point. That's like the, okay.
Yeah. But, I mean, like anything else, it's, you got to make a decision what work you're willing to do at any given moment. You know, it's like someone who has spent their whole life eating cakes and now they're diabetic, you know, and you have to make a lot of decisions at that point. Am I going to let this thing take me out and just keep eating cake?
Do I really need my foot?
Yeah. Do I really need my foot? Now that's a t-shirt. But that's the same for people like us. Like it can be a struggle. You're dealing with pretty much, you know, an unknowable, because it's all just chemicals, you know, being delivered the way they're being delivered, and one of the things that I experience is I can't ever really be sure if what I'm feeling is valid. I think my feelings are suspect almost all the time because I don't know if it's my brain giving me the wrong signals or if it's indeed just, no, this is bad right now. And, you know, your body is trying to tell you things are bad. Pay attention. Do you get any of that? Is it, like, what's your experience with your pal?
I do kind of get that experience of mistrusting my thoughts. In between reporting my sexual assault and them catching a suspect and going through that process, I was really looking to have a bad guy, to have a villain, because there was none of that.
Yeah.
For having this traumatic thing happen to me that I had no bad guy for. There was nobody I could point to and say, you did this, and you did this to me. I knew that I was trying to find a bad guy. I was trying to find a bad guy anywhere. It happened that around that time period where I was just searching and searching for a bad guy, I went through a breakup, so that made it easier. Mm-hmm. Didn't make me a better person. It didn't help me process it. But I had a bad guy for a while.
Yeah.
And thankfully, it wasn't too long after that I got a call that there was a suspect in my sexual assault, and I got to have that kind of closure happen. But I couldn't trust. I knew I shouldn't trust my thoughts when it's like, okay, this person is the bad guy, but they're not a bad guy. It just was a relationship that didn't work.
Yeah.
So that that's one of the things that I still keep in mind about how much of my thoughts can I trust. It's like, am I looking for someone to blame?
Yeah.
Am I looking for a way to deflect or project just to avoid feeling something, feeling the negative feelings, feeling depressed?
Yeah. Yeah, I can relate to wanting to deflect after an assault and find somewhere else to put things. But I didn't report anything when it happened to me. And so I think you're definitely very brave for doing it, especially knowing what we know about the system and how it fails people so regularly. And so, you know, definitely let me say, I think that's brave to go and do that and to try to make somebody be accountable for that. Because that's not the case for a lot of people. And I know why it's not the case. I mean, hell, I didn't. I mean, it was, I was a teenager and I was just going through that thing where, you know, I think for me it was a number of factors were at play. And one of those factors was, I was in a small Midwest town, and I didn't hate gay people like everyone else I knew. And so I thought, I must be gay. That's got to be what's going on. And so I dipped my toes in the water to find out if I was gay, and I found out I wasn't. But in that process, I also didn't meet a lot of the right people. And so I woke up in the middle of something. Suddenly awake. Like, oh, this is happening. And I haven't really spoken about it on the show. I've kind of talked about it a couple of times, I guess. So this is a first. But afterward, there were all of these things where it was like, well, I liked hanging out with that dude, but I didn't want to fuck him. And I certainly didn't want to get drugged and wake up. Like, I wouldn't want that to happen to me from anybody. You know, I don't care who it is. Mm. Like, someone I'm in love with, I wouldn't want them to do that to me, you know? And I barely knew this dude. And so that happened. And it was like, all right, this has colored my perception of the world. And I already knew that violence could come out of nowhere at any given time. And the thing that I didn't understand was that sexual violence can come out of anywhere at any time. And it really colored my relationships with other human beings. And I think that's what it does for a lot of assault survivors, is it makes your other relationships with humans difficult. I mean, was that your experience?
Oh, absolutely. It makes trusting people difficult.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's my experience is definitely different. It's always different.
Yeah.
It's different for everyone.
Certainly.
And my sexual assault happened at 29.
Yeah.
But it's something that I think almost every woman who I know, they have experienced some kind of sexual assaults, and I hadn't really.
Yeah.
So it was really strange for me to be finally, I shouldn't say finally, but like,
yeah.
Oh, suddenly I know, I have this added level of empathy with all these women I know, and who had been talking openly about it with me for years, and I never quite got it.
Yeah.
And then suddenly I did. Immediately I did. I think it's really important for men to talk about that too, because I don't think this is an entirely, you know, feminine experience.
No. I think it's a human experience. And I think in most cases it's probably not even about sex.
It's always about power.
Yeah. It's such a difficult thing to wrap your head around. And then to find a place in your life where not only can you trust other people again, but you can trust yourself again and learn where your own personal boundaries are and start trying to rip that trauma out and figure out where it is. And I'm still discovering things. You know,
yeah.
Like, years later, I'm still discovering bits and pieces of leftover trauma that have scarred over, and I've just taken that scar the way a person with chronic back pain takes that back pain. You just live with it until one day it's not there, and you realize, oh, I had this for this long. Okay, maybe I should do something about this. It's rough.
Yeah, it's unpredictable.
Yeah.
It can sneak up on you, like, in the strangest situations.
Yeah.
I've had panic attacks just going in my backyard and hearing somebody in the yard over.
Yeah.
Or seeing someone I didn't recognize pulling up in a car.
Mm-hmm.
I would never expect that. Those aren't connected directly with the circumstances of my assault. It's not anything that I've ever experienced a negative thing around.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden it can just hit, and it can be different. It could be one day I could have that feeling from, you know, seeing the mailman, a new mailman. And the next day, nothing.
Yeah.
Comes out of nowhere, and it's just incredibly unpredictable.
Yeah. You know, there's a part of me that has to wonder, how much mental illness we would be experiencing if these things hadn't happened to us. It's hard to quantify.
Yeah.
You really can't. But you find ways through. And you find ways back into the world and back into life.
So you didn't report. Did you find a way to find closure or to come to some kind of ending? Not ending, but...
Yeah, I really didn't. It was a thing that... it was a thing that I just kind of dealt with for a number of years. And I think what it did for me was it made me seek other people out who I felt like needed someone to protect them. And I wanted to protect people. I mean, it pushed me in another unhealthy direction is what it did. Hmm. It made me a white knight, you know, the guy that wanted to ride in and say, I can help. Because that's what I wanted to do, was I wanted to stop any other human being from ever feeling that again. And I didn't realize that's what I was doing until, you know, years and years later. And, you know, many a failed relationship where I was an emotional terrorist without even meaning to be, you know, that kind of thing. But to discover that about yourself, I think that I ended up in a place where I was able to I don't know if forgive is the right word. I was able to make peace with the fact that that's what happened. That's where it was. And that's what we got out of it. And this is what I did with that when it happened. And these are the decisions I made that made things worse. These are the decisions I made that made it better. And now let's try to move forward from here and leave that in the past rather than carry it. And ultimately, for the most part, I have. But it was a little weird to hear, like I hadn't even thought about that guy in forever because he wasn't even someone I knew very well. And then, like, decades later, somebody brought him up, was like, yeah, he turned out to be, like, addicted to a bunch of drugs and lost all his teeth, and he's in jail somewhere. It's like, oh, man. And weirdly, I felt a lot of pity for him. I felt really bad for him. And it was like, man, I hope while he's in jail, he figures out his shit. And that wasn't what I was expecting to feel. I mean, my first reaction was obviously, good, fuck that guy. But my next reaction was that. It was, I mean, if you don't mind my asking, what was your experience with coming to terms with it on your side?
Well, I got the experience of going through a trial, which was hard, but worth it. Getting to speak my truth of my experience, and then having the audience to have my victim impact statement, which is exactly that. You're telling how you were impacted as a survivor of this assault, and having a forum to talk about that and in front of the person that did it.
Yeah.
And then seeing I had the best case scenario as far as sentencing goes. My rapist is in jail, and he's in jail for a very long time.
Yeah.
And I do have mixed feelings about forgiveness with it now. So I got to have this experience. I got to speak my truth. I got to see it in his face.
Yeah.
As what I was saying really, like, it hit him. He was listening, which was shocking. And I'm still full of rage. At this man.
Yeah.
But I have that same kind of feeling of pity.
Yeah.
Because he had written me a letter from prison recently, apologizing and really going detailing what he did wrong and what thought processes contribute to it that are wrong, and why he thinks they're wrong now, and why and how he's learning. You know, maybe it was all just a lie to make himself look better for some kind of class or group or whatever. But it was nice to have that. It was nice to have him saying, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I did this. Not just apologizing, but acknowledging what he did and that it hurt me.
Yeah.
And that made me feel a lot of pity, because he had those thought processes, and if I take him on his word, which I'm choosing to do, he's realizing how awful those thoughts were, how awful he is, or at least was at that point in time. And now he has to feel that. He has to feel that self-loathing.
Yeah.
While being in prison.
And you hope that, you know, just from an empathy standpoint, that, you know, maybe this will be the thing that sinks in. But it's really hard to find your way to forgiveness on the other side of that. In fact, I don't even know if it's really even necessary. I think empathy is probably your best case scenario.
Yeah, there's a lot of different types of forgiveness that,
sure,
I think that we as survivors have to process.
That's fair.
And a big part of it is forgiveness of yourself, and not taking on all that blame. And I think forgiveness does include a significant portion of trying to set it aside and moving past it and saying, this happened. It happened.
Yeah.
It just happened. And now it's not happening. Now I'm here.
You still got to wake up in the morning after a certain point and go, all right, well, that happened and I'm brushing my teeth now.
Yes.
And that happened and I'm putting on these clothes and I'm going to leave the house. That happened and there's a period of time for some people, at least there was for me, where that was, you know, months, just that happened and I'm eating breakfast. And that happened and I'm not hungry. That happened and I'm going to drink too much tonight. That happened and I'm never drinking again. And
I am still in my and phase.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with it.
And that's great to be okay with it. Giving yourself permission to live through what you're living through. And that's amazing.
Well, as long as it's the and phase, it's not the this happened and this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened.
Yes. Yeah.
It's because this happened still... and I'm going to brush my teeth.
Yeah.
This happened and I'm going to, you know, wash my face and maybe take a shower. This happened and I'm not going to be wearing the same pajamas for a week.
But then on the flip side of all of this, it sounds like you made a really great decision to say fuck it and leave your job. And,
yes, I did.
And that could have been seen as a negative on the outside.
Well,
but really, from everything I'm hearing from you, it sounds like that was a net positive of self-care.
Yeah, well, I not only did I quit my job, but I moved in with my parents again. And it was absolutely a net positive to go from this space where I had to constantly worry about what I had to do to keep my living situation, to keep my job, to here's what I have to do to be better. Mm-hmm. Here's what I have to do to figure out what I want to do, what I want to be, how I will be happy. Instead of, okay, let me go to work. Wait, let me get up in the morning, let me get in the car, let me drive an hour, and then let me walk into the office and immediately start making calls to ruin someone's day.
Yeah.
So that I can pay rent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, maybe some people are willing to make that Faustian deal, but, you know, again, look at you with the bravery.
I don't rule out that I might go back to that at some point.
Sure.
But I want to try not to.
No, but the very idea that you felt strongly enough to make the decision to step out now, I mean, that's brilliant.
Well, thank you.
And you're making art.
And I'm making art. That's the real big step for me throughout all of this is I'm making art. I make something every day. I make something beautiful every day. That's a really big deal to me. I'm not going to an office where I hate everything I'm doing. My last job that really pushed me over the edge was I administered a drug and alcohol-free workplace program.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to work every day, calling people and telling them that they needed to take a surprise drug test within the hour.
Yeah.
And some of these people were, they're railroad workers that maybe don't even actually have any safety-sensitive functions, but they have to take a random drug test.
Yeah.
Or alcohol test. And it really ruins their day. Oh, you just got back from vacation? Well, sorry.
Yeah.
So that also absolutely pushed me over the edge into just not wanting to do that. I didn't want to do that anymore. I don't want to do it again. There's got to be some way for me to support myself that doesn't involve me hating myself and what I do.
Yeah.
So making beautiful things, I don't hate that.
Yeah.
I love that.
Well, and I love that too. I love that you're doing it. And it sounds like you've got good people in your life that are taking care of you well.
I do. Well, my mom is amazing.
Yeah.
I've got my sister recently discovered the movie Frozen. She's got a almost 2-year-old. So they're at that point.
Of course. Yeah.
So she messages me crying at least probably twice this last week because she's watching Frozen and it's about sisters who love each other.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
I just started working with an art collective at this gallery space, this pawn shop gallery, who are in a similar supportive way where the person I work closely with will tell me, no, you need to take care of yourself. Like, are you sure you're not working too much?
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you are taking care of yourself.
I'm getting there. I still have my off days where I can't get out of bed. But for the most part, I get up every day. I brush my teeth. I wash my face. I make something.
What more is there? It's enough.
It's enough for now. There might be more in the future, but I can't think that far ahead right now.
Well, I can't wait to find out. Thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
And you know what? Thank all of you. I can't thank you enough. You've been the best audience any host could ever hope to have. And so, for that, a tip of the hat to you. Make sure you go and get yourself some art and maybe even something to wear at resistanceistactile.com and support today's guest. You can always support me through the Patreon, and you can always go to our store. And that's all I got for you this week, everybody. I'm trying to decide how I'm going to wrap up the month of December. I got some cool things in the pipe for you, and they'll be announced shortly. But as always, no matter what you've been through, don't kill yourself out there.